Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Jean-Francois Bizillon, a French-born former New York City fashion editor and director who has run Bizillon's Fine Food for almost a decade at 684 South Main Street in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. I should say, he's one of my favorite people in the world. Jean-Francois, welcome.
Merci. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, you have started this institution in Great Barrington, but before we talk about that, I want to talk about your life. Where did it start? Where were you born?
I was born in Arles, which is a lovely Roman town in the south of France, in Provence. It was settled around 50 years before Christ by Julius Caesar, and a lot of the Roman monuments still exist and stand. And it's now become an extremely popular destination. Thanks to a very important photography festival that takes place in July every year, but also because it's an extraordinary place.
Provence is, of course, a place that a lot of folks who, you know, like to travel go, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like Tuscany, it's a very, very popular place to visit.
Jean-Francois, I know that Paris empties out in the summer.
Yeah.
Did they go there too?
Arles population and travelers multiply by 10 in the summer.
Uh-huh.
So it's definitely a summer destination.
Right, right. So give us a little of your history. You went to school there? Did you got a higher education?
I went to public school till the age of 15 in Arles. And then I went to the Jesuits in Avignon, which is about half an hour north of Arles, for 3 years in boarding school. Although the last year I convinced my parents to let me have my own little apartment outside the college. And then I went to Aix-en-Provence and wasted 3 years studying law and political science.
Yeah,
and
that
history.
Is a waste. That is a waste.
And then, the last year I got a little more serious and transferred to La Sorbonne in Paris and studied there for 2 years and eventually moved to New York.
And what did you study at Sorbonne?
History.
History.
Social studies, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us a little about your parents before we go on.
My parents, unfortunately, my father passed away earlier this year.
I remember.
My mother passed away 15 years ago. My father was the oldest of a pretty large family in Arles, and as it had been the tradition in the family, he was running the business, the family business, which was construction, a hardware store, that sort of things. He was a prisoner of war. He made his way back to Arles by train, by foot, hitchhiking, and it was a big surprise to the family when he came back.
What happened?
Basically, there was a program, and his father volunteered him to go to Germany, and he ended up working in a farm because my grandfather was afraid that there would be repercussion on the rest of the family, and since he had many siblings, he was very worried about the possibility of, you know, repercussion on the family. So my father, whose mother had just died at the age of 18, went to Germany and basically disappeared for the duration of the war. But he never ever spoke about it to us, his kids. There was never any mention of all of that. So it's sort of a secret part of his life.
Interesting. Did he have a profession?
Back then he had studied He had studied business. He attempted to get to HEC, which is a very high business school in Paris. Didn't make it. So when he returned from the war, he started working in the family business right away. And for many years, he sat across his father's desk and was a bit under the command of the patriarch, which was my grandfather, and couldn't really fly with his own wings, but ultimately he had new ideas. He came to the States in the early 60s for a business trip and came back with the idea of expanding the business. And he actually moved the business outside the center of Arles and expanded the business.
And what was the business again?
It was, you know, a hardware store and construction material.
Mm-hmm. So
we so could, it dealt like, it would be like Harrington.
Yeah, Harrington in Hillsdale.
In Hillsdale.
So could we say that your family was had some money?
We could say that we were comfortable, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Okay, so now you're done with the Sorbonne, pick it up. What happens then?
Then I started an internship in newspapers. I wanted to become a journalist. And I had written a number of articles for various small publications. And one summer, Le Matin, every summer, Le Matin will take some interns, and I became one of them. And what happened in France in August in Paris, like we mentioned earlier, is that everybody departs for their vacation. So the newspaper was pretty much left of in the hands of a bunch of amateurs, and one of them was me. And we sort of ran the paper, trying our best. And ultimately, at the end of the summer, I had met an American woman, and I proposed to Le Matin if I could be their stringer in New York. And since they had no one else there at the time, they said, why not? You can try. You can send us suggestions of articles, and then we'll decide if we publish them or not. So off I went, and luckily, they published a lot of them, and I was able to make a small living in New York.
What were you writing about?
Everything.
Give me an example.
They loved, in France, they loved any kind of hard news stories, you know, plane, air crash, that sort of stuff. Bernard Goetz was, I don't know if you remember, it was
Do
a vigilante. Yes, of
so
course.
So I got my job on television talking about Bernie Goetz.
Right. Yeah. So there was a lot of that, and that's what they seemed to respond. But I also did a lot of interviews and profile on French business people in New York and outside New York, restaurateur, I talked about food, that sort of stuff. Did a piece on the Cousteau organization in Maryland. But, you know, a lot of French people settled in the States doing business. That seemed to be a good subject to write about.
So, you know, there's this dissonance sometimes between the people here and the people in France. Were you subjected to any of that early on?
I was, but not to a great extent. You know, nothing really serious.
Okay, so you're writing these articles, and they're paying you, and you're in the States. And then what happened?
Then I was lucky to apply to. I wanted to work for an American newspaper. So I went around and met, I went to the Hartford Courant. I sent my resume to maybe 50 newspapers.
Hmm.
And most of them rejected my requests. Probably insecure on, not so sure on the fact that I could write in English. And I realized that I also had these limitations. So eventually I had a small job at Condé Nast Publishing Company as a rover, what they call a rover, which is you travel through different departments to help whichever editors. And that turned out to be quite interesting. And then I resume my career as a journalist freelance for a year or two. And then I went back to Condé Nast as an editor at GQ Magazine.
Wow. Now, how did you fit in there? How did that happen?
I had been freelancing on photo shoots, helping my then wife, pretty much as a messenger, bringing clothing to the studios, scouting locations, making returns to the different department stores and showrooms. And ultimately, she was busy, and some of her jobs fell on my lap, which I was happy to take. And I built a little career.
She was fired?
No, she was very busy.
Oh, busy.
And she had enough work that I could take some of it.
Right.
And so I developed a portfolio, and eventually I got an agent. And eventually GQ heard of me, this French male stylist in New York, which was not so common at the time. And they wanted to sort of shift a bit the tone of the fashion pages at GQ. They wanted to appeal to maybe a broader audience with a different point of view. So they brought me in, and I worked there for a year and a half. And eventually I went to freelance for the New York Times Magazine, the fashion section of the New York Times Magazine.
Really? Do you remember how you got that job?
I went to see the editor, and she had heard of me at the New York Times, and she said, yeah, you can start next week.
Do you get money, a lot of money for writing those?
No, you don't write. You basically produce the fashion shoots.
I see.
And you work with designers and create stories and themes which eventually end up on the page. To give you an example, it could be a story about tweeds, and you will go around and find among the different designers the one that I've worked around the theme of tweeds, and you create a whole story and fashion spreads around that.
So all of a sudden you're a big fashion guru.
Well, I wouldn't say I was a fashion guru, but you know, I was enjoying the work and traveling all over the country, and had a chance to meet extraordinary photographers and models, and for a while it was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful.
Was your wife an American or French?
She was American. She's American.
She's American. And you had children?
Yes, we had two kids. We have two kids together. One is 25. Mm-hmm. He lives in New York. He works in the hospitality business. He worked at the beer garden at the Standard, and now he's an assistant general manager in a nightclub, pretty large nightclub. And my daughter is a student. She's actually trying to transfer from the school she's in now to go back to New York, but next semester she has planned to go to Copenhagen and finish her third year there.
Yeah. So you had developed this tremendous expertise in clothing and in shoots. What happened?
Then I was still freelancing quite a bit on the side, and the agent at the time hooked me up with a company called Nautica. And Nautica was in need of creating runways for men's fashion. They were trying to elevate a bit their brand and have more of a designer slant rather than just a t-shirt bathing suit company. So I went there and picked up a fashion show that had already been started by another guy, but had left, or they were not happy with his work. And I did one fashion show about 20 years ago. And they seemed pretty satisfied, so they asked me to work on the next season's fashion show. And on the third round, I kind of implied to them that I would need to go to Paris and Milan and London to sort of observe the trends and see how we could adapt our point of view based on my research in Europe. And so they agreed to that. So I ended up going every 6 months and spent 15 days in Europe looking at stores, looking at fabrics, and bringing back a point of view that I would explain to the designers in the company.
And
that was a great, great job. That was actually one way for me to get acquainted with all the restaurants and food places that I had wanted to go but couldn't afford when I was a student in Paris. But now that I was on an expense account, and that I was the French guy and I was working directly with the founder of the company, he wanted me to take everybody and sort of be the guide and choose the wine. And so we had a great, you know, we had usually a very pleasant, hedonistic kind of trips.
Did the boss go with you?
The boss came with me, yeah. Hmm. And this is also where I met my current wife, Helen, and we together planned the idea of leaving the fashion industry.
What about the old wife?
Well, there was a divorce.
You forgot to tell us about that. What went wrong?
Well, things happen, you know, people change, and we sort of fell out of love and our relationship ended.
Well, now the French are famous for l'amour, you know. I mean, they really are. So it's a different cultural code, I think. in France than there is here in the United States. We're more puritanical, don't you think?
I think you're correct.
Yeah. If you have an American woman married to a Frenchman, maybe not everybody understands, has the same set of rules.
Yeah, I know what you're trying. I know where you're going, but yeah, there is definitely a difference of culture. But in my case, this was under.
Yeah. Okay, so you meet the beautiful Helen, and she is gorgeous and wonderful and nice. Terrific. And you decide you're looking for something else to do. Now, why? I mean, you know, you had this fashion thing by the tail. Why would you do something else?
Well, first of all, there's an age limit to when you work in fashion. You become obsolete by the time you reach 40. Very few people survive past a certain age, except a few dinosaurs.
I remember, Jean-Francois, when I came into your store one day, you had this really funny thing that you did to me. You handed me a bottle of Rien, but you knew that the top could not be taken off the bottle, and you did that. You were a practical joker.
That was a complete practical joke, yes.
Yeah,
I had prepared the bottle and sealed it in such a way that it could not be opened.
That's.
I just played up into the Peter Sellers type of humor where, you know, this is the l'essence and you can't open the bottle because it's just not going to open for you.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay, so now you and Helen, what did Helen do? She's Irish, right?
She's Irish. She's from Dublin.
Dublin.
She was born in Dublin. She had worked at a competitor of Nautica, Ralph Lauren, and she came on board a few years after I was there. And she was in charge. She worked in a department called Creative Services, which is to set up the windows, showrooms, all the sort of interior architecture of what a company like this requires. And she worked really hard on opening a store for the company at Rockefeller Center.
Yeah.
So she worked in a different department, but eventually our work sort of merged.
At some level,
I should not have said that. I can see that your eyebrows are raising, and I know where you're going with this.
But. No, I'm not going anywhere. I would never do that to you. Now, do the Irish and the French get along well together?
Well, these two do. Yeah. We have a certain amount of work, but it seems to work.
Yeah. So, okay. So now bring us in on the discussion for this life-transforming experience. You're both there. You're both making good money. You're living in New York. With the capital of the world, maybe. And you look at each other and say, we don't want to be doing this anymore, right?
Yes. I always felt uncomfortable and very vulnerable to have to be there in order to make a living. In other words, if I didn't work, because I was on a contract basis, if I didn't show up, I was basically not paid. Let's say if I wanted to take a break, I was not capable of doing it. And my idea was to have a business that eventually could fly on its own, and my function would be more to oversee it, but not necessarily always do FaceTime.
Yeah.
This is why we thought of a bar, bistro, /store. It may not be exactly that definition, but that's, you know, it's close enough. And I also had been to Massachusetts on a 4th of July weekend visiting a friend and absolutely fell in love with the area.
With the Berkshires?
The Berkshires. And that was in Worthington, which is about an hour east, still in the Berkshires or just at the fringe of the Berkshires. Mm-hmm. And on that weekend, I bought an old farmhouse, which was in a very bad state and needed major repairs.
In Worthington?
In Worthington, with 100 acres.
Wow.
And on weekends, I would come from New York and work on the house and learn carpentry and electricity and all of that and fence the field, reclaim the fields, talk to a farmer. He put his cows in the fields, cut trees, all that work. And enjoyed it tremendously. Having grown up in a small rural area outside Arles, I was... attracted to this kind of life.
Now, were you married to Helen at that point?
No, I was married to Kate then.
Okay.
And every Sunday night when we went back to New York, I was dreading the trip back and the week ahead.
Yeah, well, that's what all of us faced. That's how we all got there.
That's right.
But it's hardly a unique story. That's what happens
I agree.
To you. Yeah.
So it took me a while for a while I had all these fantasies, ideas of selling Woodfire in New York, setting up a general store in New York, trying to get products out of Massachusetts into New York, while I was still in the fashion business. And nothing of this happened. And then eventually, a friend of mine, when we were in the beginning phase of planning the store that we have now, and originally we had planned to do it in Brooklyn, Williamsburg, where we lived.
Oh, in Williamsburg.
Right. A friend of mine, knowing how much money it required to operate in New York, said, why don't you come to Great Barrington and check it out again. Have a look.
Is this friend lives in Great Barrington?
No, she lives in Worthington.
In Worthington, I see. But she suggested Great Barrington?
Yeah, she said you should really check it out. You know, you know Worthington, and you know it's probably a little small for what you want to do, but Great Barrington might be the right place. And so we did. We came and explored it on day trips from New York. Isabelle was then 3 or 4 months old. And we would leave early in the morning and line up all the ducks, and then leave at night and do the next trip a week later, let's say. So throughout the summer of 2003, we did our exploring, and then we signed in on to.
So you were looking for a place, and you had pretty well made up your mind what you wanted, right?
We sort of were not completely certain about what we would do in terms of the restaurant part, or the cafe part, rather. Helen was not in favor of seating people, whereas I was, because I saw it as our way to make a living. Mm-hmm. And we also were not so sure about certain items in the store, but ultimately we went ahead and did it.
What kind of items did you want in the store?
I wanted pretty much what we have now. Helen wasn't so sure about having certain items. I forget what it was.
Imported mustards and sauerkrauts and... These are the things I buy there, but they're not cheap, and they're imported.
Some are imported, and a lot of products are locally sourced.
I see.
We worked, you know, all the salads, vegetables, greens, all of that is grown within 3 miles. In the summer times, the tomatoes come from farmers in the area. Cheese, a lot of cheese come from local sources.
But it's very French.
A fair amount of Italian and French products. And some Spanish products, yeah.
Well, what's interesting to me is how you go there and you get every expatriate Frenchman. People come in there, they speak French. It's a sort of little bit of France. Now, the interesting thing about the place itself, it's, what, a mile or two out of Great Barrington?
Yeah, mile and a half.
Yeah, mile and a half. Is that it is not a walk-in place. It's not a place you're walking along the street and say, hey, this is neat, let's go in here. So you've had to really work to establish a clientele and a reputation. And a lot of people, it's a destination place, but it's not a destination foo-foo restaurant. It's a destination where people go during the day. You make eggs in the morning and bacon and jambon and, you know, things of that kind. And Jean-François, you've got a big classic French table there that people have to share and get along, even if they don't like each other, and sit there and talk to each other and the rest of it. Now, tell us, is there a philosophy of French food that is different from the philosophy of American food?
There is. Food in France, like many other endeavors, has to be pleasurable. And all my life in New York, when I worked in offices, corporations, I could not go out to lunch. People eat on their desk. That is, to me, the most unpleasant sacrifice one makes. So it has to be pleasurable. It has to be a moment where you chat, eat, savor what you eat, meet up with friends or family, and that's a big difference. Food has changed enormously in the last 25, 28 years that I've been here in America. It's unbelievable how everything is here. You have amazing stores, not only in New York, but everywhere, where you can find all the items that seem to be very scarce or non-existent back in the 80s. Olive oil is one example.
Yes, you've specialized in olive oil.
We do.
When did you come to that?
I come from an olive oil country, olive oil growing area, yeah. Provence. And as a kid, we used to do the harvest. My father had maybe 20 trees, and we would bring it to the mill, like many other families did, and get a few liters of olive oil. Olive oil is an extraordinary, noble product. It has enormous health enhancing qualities. It elevates any kind of food, and if you deal with the best olive oil, then it's a given. It's not luxury, but it changes everything.
Tell us the difference between, you know, bad olive oil and good olive oil, and what's the nomenclature around olive oil. You know, there's virgin olive oil, and then there's extra virgin olive oil. I think there's virgin olive oil. So I made that last one up. So I just love it if you could give us a little tour through this.
Extra virgin olive oil has to do with a level of acidity in the olive oil. The level is 0.8%. So anything under that level is extra virgin.
Yeah.
Virgin olive oil is above that number. So it can have 3% of acidity and it's virgin. There's been a lot of writing. The New Yorker published a story about 10 years ago about the tampering of olive oil and how much money is being made with products that is not the pure product. It's equivalent to what drug does. I mean, it's a whole mafia around the olive oil. But the New Yorker exposed it, and since then there's been enormous changes in the industry. There's another book that just came out last spring called Extra Virginity, which explains very well the difference between good olive oil and bad olive oil. The olive oil we source, we deal with very, very small producers, people who have sometimes less than 1,000 trees. And their olive oil typically is not imported elsewhere. We try to get an exclusive when we work with these people. Most of that olive oil is sold locally to people who come directly to the farm, or they sell at farmers market. And that's sort of our niche. We work with people who are extremely dedicated, attend every aspect of the production of the olive oil, prune the trees, don't do much to the land, do the harvesting, bring it to the mill or mill it themselves. And it's been an extraordinary experience. We were in Tuscany 2 years ago during the harvest and stayed with the people we buy from. It's a family. We of course have done that in Provence as well. And it's every time an extremely pleasurable experience. And I'm proud to say that we have an exclusive, beautiful, extraordinary product in our store.
And when you walk into your store, you see these enormous sort of metal vats.
Stainless steel, yeah.
You know, stainless steel vats. And you have labeled each of these with a different, you know, olive oil. You've said this is what this does and this does. So are there some olive oils that you should eat with meat and some olive oils you should eat with? It's just like wines, in other words.
You can definitely pair your olive oil the same way you pair wine with food. I'm not one to dictate what a person can do or not do with the olive oil or any other products. But it's true that a peppery olive oil, such as the one from Tuscany, works very well on a grilled steak, and when it's poured over the steak when it's been cooked. It's also true that a grassy olive oil matches very well tomatoes or mesclun or arugula. So you can go into this refinement, and people seem to really respond to that.
How does something get to be a grassy olive oil?
Grassy defines the aroma. And like wine, olive oil has a characteristic that differs from the next one. So it's grassy in the sense, the word is in French, herbacé. When you feel that it's fresh hay that has just been, you know, cut or harvested, that's sort of, it's to define the aroma.
But where does it get the aroma from? I mean, if you have an olive tree, does it get it from the field that's standing right next to it?
It's the aroma is defined by what everybody talks about, which is le terroir, the soil, the climate, and the people who work on it. And for instance, in Italy, in Tuscany rather, they pick the olives very early, green, instead of letting them mature and turn black. What that does is
so all green olives would eventually turn black?
Yes.
I never knew that.
So what that does is that it creates a very pungent, very full body olive oil.
Right.
Because it's been pressed green. In Provence, they've been doing what we call the fruité noir, so they wait for the olives to mature, and the chemistry change at when the olives gets pressed, and it gives a much more subtle, sometimes even almost sweet result in the olive oil, which this is why it's often used in pastries. You can use it in cakes mixed with honey, let's say, or even alcohol.
How about cooking? We use olive oil. We're peasants when it comes to what we use. We just, you know, put some olive oil in the pan and put something in that. Some people have told me that you shouldn't use olive oil at high temperatures. Is that right?
Well, you lose the aroma when you heat the oil. There's a point where the aroma is gone. So you could cook and get the same results if you bring the olive oil to a high level with any kind of oil. However, some oils will impact the taste, a bit like peanut oil. It has sort of a fishy taste if you cook vegetables. So the olive oil stays quite neutral, but you kind of lose the aroma if you bring it to a heat. But if you keep olive oil at a medium heat and sauté vegetables, that is the best way to cook. You know, it's healthy, and it's really a great vehicle to sauté, to gently fry, and that's how I cook.
Do you use the olive oils, which you have in great profusion in your store, do you use them on the web? Do you sell them that way too?
We do, and we also wholesale.
What do you mean by that?
Well, we have about 20 stores and restaurants that buy our olive oil and in turn use it in their kitchen or resell it to their clients.
Well, who does the selling?
I do. We do.
Do you have to travel around?
Usually try to, when we prospect for new customers, we try to go to locations that might be also attractive enough for us to vacation. So, for instance, Martha's Vineyard we have 3 stores who buy from us there in Martha's Vineyard.
Can you tell us how you landed the accounts?
I just went and knocked at the door and explained what I did. And some people sort of caught on, knew that this was coming and had read about the system that we have. And then some say no, of course. You know, it's not always a given, but...
Yeah.
But
some say, send me a little and we'll tell you.
And so we leave samples and then we call back, you know, the usual sales call and call back, revisit, and eventually, you know, 15% of the people we see or 20% of the people take the jump. And usually they stay. We've had a few accounts that are now with us for 3 or 4 years.
Well, is this the only way you'll be able to make it when you wholesale? In other words, the store is great, but people in New York to rent a space like yours might spend $30,000 a month. So you don't, but then again, on the other hand, the people who are coming to the store are not, the N, as we say, is not nearly as high as it is in one square block in Manhattan. But I wanted to ask you about something else. I wanted to talk about the French culture and cuisine. And you go into the diner in Great Barrington and you get a half a plate full of hash brown potatoes with your eggs and, you know, a lot of stuff. I noticed that in your place, you don't get a lot. Is that the way the French eat?
Yeah. We purposely don't pile the food onto the plate. I remember coming to New York and going to a deli and ordering a sandwich, and they were stratas of different meats. None of them made sense together. And the peppers and the tomatoes and the salami and the soppressata and all the cheese in it. And it was, you know, it made me sick. I ate the sandwich in the course of the following week, I think, breaking it up in small pieces. I mean, it was just not the way I think it should be. So in our place, we do serve fairly small amounts in, you know, for that reason. We don't believe that it should be pile high.
Well, people love
just you, right.
People of discernment love the store.
Yeah.
And come in all the time. My wife Roselle is a huge fan. They come in and there is a sort of a cultural draw from the place that you don't see in other institutions. Now, you know, I don't know, I'll get into trouble for this, but you know, the whole concept of Cosa Nostra, which is our thing. Now that's an organized crime. But I also think that there are a number of cultural institutions which are our thing and which people gravitate towards, and they love the fact that, you know, it's there. So, for example, opera is one. Many of the not-for-profit organizations, particularly some of the environmental ones, which do God's work. I mean, I'm not putting that down at all. But, you know, it becomes a place where some of the land trusts, for example, where, you know, some very wealthy people end up doing their thing together. And I think the long way around, the restaurant, your restaurant, Biseon, south of Great Barrington by just a little, is such a place. I think I've seen people come up from Connecticut to be there. I've seen people come up from the city to be there. I've heard from people in Woodstock that they come over because it's different. And anybody who has anything French in their background, you know, maybe their mother was French, maybe they lived in France, they become adherence to this sort of club. Is it enough, is my question.
Well, it's, I like the analogy with the mafia, because our family actually originally came from the south of Italy, and it's believed that the name was Bisaglioni.
Interesting.
I also, and Helen as well, adore Italy, and we spent a great time together there when we first met. And any opportunity to go back is welcome in our little world.
So places like Positano and, you know. And
yeah, or even Milan, or even, you know, yeah. Firenze, or yeah. Naples, or Panaria, Venice, of course. But I think that in some ways, having a place like ours is a place where you host. You make introductions to people. You hold their hands if a disaster or tragedy has happened. You build them up again to face the world. It's beyond just the food or the coffee or the wine. It's, you care. And even the people who you don't care for, if they don't show up after a month or so, you start worrying about them. Even the people who annoyed you in the first place, you start worrying. Well, what happened to that guy? Is he all right? Or what happened, you know, that kind of thing. And for me, that's what brings me to work. It's such a pleasure to be there, because not only there are French people and people who have traveled to France and American who love France, but there are also Brazilians and Italians and Greek and English, a lot of English people from all over the world that travel through Route 7 and luckily sometimes stop at our place. And that, to me, is an extraordinary experience.
But so much of what you do there is reputational. One person tells another.
Yeah. We don't advertise, so it's all word of mouth. Yeah. We did advertise on the radio station when we first opened. But we realized that being a small place and being a food place, it's really the word of mouth that works the best.
Well, I'm fascinated by this idea of expatriates of all stripes finding this as their place. You know, the Italians, the British. And it is true that I have seen people try out different languages on you now. How many languages can you speak?
I barely speak English, and I have notions of Spanish. Uh-huh. And, of course, a little bit of Italian. And
well, it's amazing French. How many people in Europe can speak five languages and think of nothing of it. Whereas in this country, if you can do anything in a second language, you're regarded as a national hero.
No comments.
But it's true. I mean, you know, any waiter in any, you know, in any one of those outdoor places has to speak five languages or four languages.
Well, I know how to fake it a bit, so
Yeah. Well, maybe they do too.
Yeah.
The next place I want to go has to do with the creativity that you showed in the fashion industry, and now you've shown this creativity in developing here. What's next?
Well, at this point, at this point in my life, I'm not sure that I want to embark into anything too drastic. I once calculated or put down the number of little jobs that I've done in my life, and I think I reached around 60.
No kidding.
Yeah. So I will hope that we can keep this one going and develop the network of olive oil further. And
but it keeps growing, doesn't it? The number of people who go into the place.
But you know, Alan, you never know. You never know. Yeah. You never know. It can plateau or it can change. You know, it's you're never sure what will happen next.
Now, what are some of the specialty items if you go in there and you look into the case?
Well,
what are you likely to see?
We do very well with prosciutto.
Which What's is the secret of prosciutto?
It's the cured ham that comes from Italy. There are different degrees of aging, and we carry the prosciutto that is the regular prosciutto that you put in a sandwich, and then there's the San Daniele, which is aged a little longer, and then there's also the Serrano that comes from Spain, which is also a cured.
Well, how long
ham.
Has that meat been hanging around?
it can be up to 2 years.
Really?
Yeah. It's obviously...
How do they cure it?
They cure it with salt, and it's hung, and it's air-dried, and it's delicious for the most part. I've tried myself to do some, and it was a complete disaster in the cellar of our store. Because you have to maintain humidity as well as a certain temperature. And if you do it with the elements without a proper case in our area, where the temperature changed drastically from winter to summer, then you run into the problems that I had. So the three attempts that I've made were not very successful.
Now, the French are known for not being, fat. And they have low cholesterol. And yet, you know, these products you've been talking about would lead one to think that we're now approaching heart attack land. What's your theory on why the French escape all of this? I know one of the theories is red wine, but who knows?
Yeah, red wine is proven to be good for your health. Up to, I think the word is 2 glasses a day. The fear is that if you eat at regular time during the day, and maybe only 3 times a day, it's fairly small amount like we discussed earlier, and if you use your legs when you can, which means walking, using stairs, jump on a bicycle, you can get all the exercise that one needs. And I think the French are very conscious about their waste, including the men. When they get on the beach, they are not muscular by all means. They don't go to the gym that much, but they also want to stay kind of trim. The ideal of a body on a beach, I think, is quite different there than it is here. People don't really look at the muscles and the biceps and all of that, from what I recall in France. But they don't like, you know, the tie around the waist. So men are very conscious of that. And without having to go to the gym, they also are careful what they put in their mouth. Also, you have to remember, we don't really drink any Coca-Cola or sodas. Or very few people do. Soft drinks. It's water or wine. And that's the end of it.
Fascinating. I know you ride a bicycle incessantly. What's that? Is that something?
Well, the commute,
is that cultural?
It's my way to kill 2 birds with 1 shot. It's my way to exercise, but also to get to work. So it's my commute. Luckily, the road is fairly flat, and it's only 5 miles. Actually, Helen has been much more often on the bike than I have, because I also like riding the Vespa. And that sort of is less exercise on the bike, but still very pleasurable.
about the way the French and the Americans perceive each other? Are you ever sort of snotty when you see, you know, the ugly American come into the store and, act out?
No. Unless they are unpleasant and rowdy, and I've had that, but it's not necessarily a trait of the Americans.
Well, but you are an enforcer of the rules. You know, if people break the rules, you're going to let them know in that store.
In my kingdom, I am, yes.
Yeah, I see that.
Yeah.
What is it that might tick you off?
Not very much at this point. Maybe I have sort of become more tenderized.
Mellow,
yeah. Yeah. But I've had situations where I've asked people to leave.
Well, can you remember one of them?
I do. I have one rule which I'm happy to see now is more and more present on menus. And one of the rules is we don't really like to change things around. We don't like to substitute. We don't like to. It sort of create havoc in the little kitchen. And we have carefully designed our sandwich in such a way that we think they are the best. And the whole
wonderful baguettes, beautiful cured as meats, as you say.
And the whole idea of giving the opportunity to the customer to change things around sort of ruin what we have done. And so one time somebody said, "That's stupid." And I thought that was a bit harsh. And he also slammed the menu on the counter. And he was a tall guy, a tall fellow, maybe, you know.
Oh, my.
6'4". But I was so shocked that he could behave in such a way that I went up to him and I said, "I think you are stupid, and please leave the store." And he said, "You can't let me go. This is a public place." I said, "No, it's not a public place." And so he eventually left. But there's been a few episodes.
Yeah.
This is one of them. Yeah. But very few.
But you do have rules. I know you don't like it when somebody brings a coffee in to your coffee store from another place.
Well, that's common sense. We sell coffee, so you don't bring your coffee to a coffee place.
Yeah. That's true. That's true. So tell me about your children. How are they being raised?
The two little ones, Isabel and Anouk, are, I think, having a wonderful life. They jump on the bus and go to school in about 3 or 4 minutes around the corner. It's a lovely school. I encourage them to spend a lot of time outdoor. We have a small garden, but next to us there is a farm. And they are adept at going and checking the animals and exploring the little mountain behind. They pretty much live the life that's similar to the life I had. You know, it's outdoor, friends, bicycles.
How about language? Do they speak fluent French?
I try, but unfortunately, they are resisting.
Interesting.
And they might repeat a few things, but ultimately they say, "Papa, please stop speaking French. We don't want to speak French. Stop." And it's hard
they'll be sorry later on.
I know. We should have the rule of only speaking French at home, and that would work, except that Helen is sometimes struggling with it too, so I am the minority. I'm again 3 women here, so.
Does she speak?
She understands completely everything.
Yeah, but does she speak fluent Gaelic?
No, she doesn't, but she speaks a few words. However, one of her first French word that she used is something that I'm not going to say on air, but it's obviously a bad word.
Uh-huh.
And she uses it very naturally. It comes out very quickly.
Uh-huh. Has to do with fertilizer?
Has to do with the oldest profession on the street.
Oh, I see. So this all sounds so idyllic. It sounds like that's why I wanted to have you on, because I love stories in which people who are creative and do something a little bit different and then show that it can be done and the rest. How about writing it all up and selling it as a book?
I have contemplated the idea of putting that in a book, but it's extremely hard to write well anyway. I also would want to write it in English, but there are some problems there. But I have to be honest. I have written probably 200 pages of my story. Yeah. And there is a book that inspired me to do that, which was written by Jacques Pépin, which is called The Apprentice. And it's a extremely endearing and fascinating tale of his life, growing up in the Lyon area and then working in kitchen from the age of 14 and then becoming who he's become. He's a wonderful guy, and it's very humble and very personal. It's a great book, really good book. I've read a few times. In fact, when he published the book, I had the nerve to write to him and tell him a bit of my story, and he was such a gentleman that he wrote back despite his busy schedule and sent me a lovely handwritten note with a drawing that he had done. And so that is kept in the book preciously. And I'm hoping to meet him at some point.
At some point he'll be coming through the Berkshires.
We hope so.
Yeah. I love the Berkshires, of course, and we chose this as our home the same way that you did. If you had to describe what was so unique about our area, what would you say? What are the ingredients?
It's the perfect blend of people, nature, and a few very good institutions, cultural institutions. The Mehui is extraordinary.
Mehui Theater.
Yes.
Yeah. Great play.
Tanglewood, of course. Jacob's Pillow. So you can have, and then I walk a lot, so I go on the Appalachian Trails and the various reservation. And you can isolate yourself within 10 minutes and be lost in the woods or in the trails. And have this fabulous experience, and you could meet a bear, or you could meet a deer, or you could meet a rabbit, but it's all there, and it's incredibly fragile, because of course we are at the mercy of big box stores, which is a threat right now in our town, Sheffield. But at the same time, it's extraordinary that it's been preserved. In this day and age, there's not many areas in the States, or even in France for that matter, that are intact.
Has the governor ever walked into your store?
Yes.
He's a wonderful man, isn't he?
He's amazing.
Yeah. He's a guy who can sort of, that's Deval Patrick, who can sort of nose out what's good and, you know, and get there.
Yeah, he came, and the second time he came, he had a woman bodyguard, which I had never seen, so that was fun. But in the first time he came, the bodyguard stayed a little behind and bought himself a few pâtés and things. So that was after the governor was finished with his shopping. So it was quite endearing to see that.
Our guest has been the magnificent friend Jean-François Bizillon of Bizillon's Fine Foods in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. I loved having you here. It's a different kind of story. It is unique, and I really love the fact that you've done it and done it so well.
Thank you so much.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.